Welcome to this session of the Futures Forum. Those who follow our forums closely will remember that last year we listened to the editor of the New Daily, Bruce Guthrie, talk about the role of the media in the future. Tonight we switch the theme a little and are talking about the role of the future in the media. All of us know that we ought to be paying more attention to the future, but many of us find this too difficult and give up. Most of us also agree that the media is at very least capable of setting agendas for discussion, and hence our interest in how the media deals with the future. To the best of my knowledge, the only regular program on Australia's media with the word future in the title is Future Tense on ABC Radio National, and it is the host of that program who is our guest this evening. Anthony Fennell has been involved with Future Tense since it began in 2009, a position he moved to after many years in other news and current affairs programs. He's a Walkley Award winner and the author of The Future and Related Nonsense, written in 2012. Welcome, Anthony, and thank you for keeping the future at the forefront of our thinking.
Thank you very much. I have to say up front that I've deliberately designed this piece as a provocation, so I'll be interested to hear your thoughts at the end of it. My job here today, as you just said, is to look at the role of the future in the media, and I propose to do that by first critiquing our modern understanding of the concept of the future, then looking at those most responsible for helping to frame our perceptions of the future, and finally examining what role I believe the future could actually play in our media in a positive sense. And I say that because I think in many ways the future has, on the one hand, been hijacked by vested interests, and on the other, been allowed to wither in its potency as a tool for social advancement. So let me start by elaborating on that final point. I was talking with Kim McKay, the director of the Australian Museum in Sydney, a few weeks back, and one thing that really stuck in my mind from that discussion was a comment she made toward the end of our conversation about the way in which many of us imagine what lies ahead. She was talking specifically about the way we often tend to portray the media, particularly in a pictorial or visual sense, and she said that she increasingly found that the future was reduced to a sort of Jetson-style retro trope. You know, kitsch and camp and really more about past visions and ambitions rather than fresh imaginings of what might actually lie over the horizon. That comment struck a chord with me because only a few days before I'd had a similar thought while checking my program's Twitter feed and seeing a plethora of retro-futuristic images posted by people involved in the tech industry. Now, it's always been fashionable to be nostalgic to an extent, and when it comes to space in particular and the futuristic images of the 50s and 60s specifically, there is a kind of wonderment and awe captured in much of the sci-fi and or popular media of that period that continues to give those images enormous ongoing currency. Many of them were fantastical in their style and ambition in a way that isn't in vogue in new original conceptions of the future in the second decade of the 21st century. Kim McKay was in part questioning why that was and regretting the fact that contemporary visions of the future somehow often seem disappointingly derivative. That observation took me back to another conversation that I had several years ago at a conference on design organised by Griffith University here in Brisbane. One of the speakers at that conference was a fellow named Cameron Tonkinwise, a lecturer at Parsons, the New School of Design in New York. And in his presentation, Tonkinwise lamented the fact that while his students were smart, they were talented and they were alert, they were fearful, he said, of indulging in fantasy. They not only found it unfashionable to fantasise, his words, they were frightened of doing so, preferring instead to adopt a strategy of cautious interest when it came to their own efforts in assessing and identifying future trends and directions. And I have to confess that that was one of the most disappointing things I've ever heard, and it still remains. It's stuck in my head and it still remains one of the most disappointing things I've ever heard, because when you think about it, you know, when young design students at a top international design school start losing the will to be wildly creative, to start imagining the unimaginable, let's face it, we have a serious problem. Now, why this should be the case is an arguable matter. Like most trends, these things take time to build, even if we don't notice the iterations of their development. So circling back to Kim McKay's comment, I started to wonder whether a reliance on cliched images of past futuristic visions was indicative simply of the fear to speculate. And if that was indeed the case, I asked myself, what then was the driving that fear? Now, I pondered on that for a while, particularly knowing that this presentation was coming up and that the question would be relevant for this occasion. But then I began to question my initial thoughts, to think, was I reading too much motivation into the actions of students? After all, one explanation that you could put forward is one of simple laziness. In other words, that in an age where things are increasingly done for us, not by us, why should we even bother to think of the future? Why not simply rely on previous incarnations? Why create a new when you can just as easily cut and paste, as it were, from previous decades and other people's imaginings? That's a seductive argument for a middle-aged creative type like myself, I have to confess, someone who's always wary of where the world is heading. But I think there's more at play than a simple lack of personal motivation. And I would argue that as a society, I think we've slowly lost the skill to interpret and interrogate for ourselves. And worse still, I'd suggest, we've become too dependent on others to help us frame the nature of our current existence and also the future. And in that regard, our current tools of communication are not our friends, I would suggest. You could argue, and many increasingly do, that the digital devices and platforms that now dominate our everyday lives help to keep us in the moment. Your Facebook account, for example, may include something called a timeline, but the platform is actually about expressing temporaneous thoughts. Twitter is even more immediate, and the messaging service Snapchat is so completely and utterly of the moment as to be almost out of the moment before it's begun. Enjoy fast and fun mobile conversation, the Snapchat website declares in describing its service. Snap a photo or a video, add a caption, and send it to a friend. They'll view it, laugh, and then the snap disappears. And by disappears, they mean, of course, that the recipient of a Snapchat message will only have between 1 to 10 seconds to view the content before it's gone. The ultimate in self-destructing messages. Now, there is, of course, nothing intrinsically wrong with such services. They are popular because they have genuine appeal. But we need to recognise them for what they really are and what they're about. They are not really concerned with dimensions of time, whether forward or backward. They are very much about the now. The main reason for this is because most modern social media platforms are not about record in the way that newspapers used to be, or even television news used to be. They're about attention. Primarily, they're designed as marketing platforms, and as such, they offer a space where companies compete for eyeballs. It's all about throwing things before people and moving on. And that's what we, in turn, the users do. We speak what's on our mind, and we compete for the attention of others in so doing. But as I say, it's all in and about the moment. Let me be clear, the digital age is an age like any other. It has its potential as well as its problems. But it is not the automatic path to creativity and progress that techno-enthusiasts would have us believe it is. Many media and technology theorists, from Douglas Rushkoff to Nicholas Carr to Yevgeny Morozov, have pondered the disempowering nature of modern technology, or at least the disempowerment that comes from being too unquestioning of its usage. Used without ambition or creativity, our modern digital tools lead to passivity. The reality of technology usage in the 21st century is that it is much more passive than we would like to admit. Many people are content simply to consume the technology put in front of them, to use it in the ways that technology developers, or more to the point, technology companies, tell them that it should be used. And in a sense, why should we imagine that would be any different? We are consumers, after all, in a consumer-driven world, at least in the affluent West. This is an age, don't forget, in which politicians and other leaders regularly talk of the economy, when they mean the society, and where the term consumer has come to replace the notion of the citizen. As grateful consumers, we wait for the next object of consumption to be put in front of us, and we wait to be told what we should be doing and how we should do it. And like our notions of the present, then, our conceptions of the future are also increasingly decided by the corporations that provide us with those consumables. In this vein, the future is whatever Apple determines it to be, or Samsung, or Google, or any number of other wealthy entrepreneurs like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. And they reward us for our passivity and our money by giving us new gadgets and new platforms to salivate over. Gadgets that we simply must have in order to stay at the very forefront of fashion and change. And journalists, I have to say, are among the most passive of all, the most eager to be led. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Ask most journalists what the future of transport holds, and they're likely to respond with a pat line about the driverless car, not about the possibility of more pedestrian-only walkways being built in cities to deal with the traffic complications of ever-increasing urbanisation, not about a greater increase in underground public transport systems as a result of above-ground congestion, and not about official government prescriptions regulating and decreasing vehicle ownership within our cities. As I say, if you ask most journalists what the future of transport holds, and they'll pretty quickly parrot the driverless car. Now, why? Well, I would say that it's because Google, in particular, has invested millions of dollars in the technology and spent millions more creating a media buzz around the idea. Will the driverless car ever come to pass? We did a full program on it about 2 years ago, and the answer there was, it's entirely possible. Who knows? But the point is that all of those other scenarios, or combinations of them, are equally likely over time, given certain social, environmental, and political circumstances. Now, let me pause for a moment and just summarise all of that. My argument so far is that a growing passivity within society shapes the way many of us view issues and concepts, and one of those is the concept of the future. That passivity, I would argue, is tied to the types of technology we use and which encourage consumption above all else. And the developers of that technology are the ones who increasingly shape what we do and what we believe. And finally, one of the main conduits for that process is journalism. Journalists still have enormous power, but in many ways we already live in a post-journalistic world, at least as far as quality reporting is concerned, the questioning, investigative, sceptical stuff. Newsrooms across the Western world have been gutted as revenues have plummeted and online advertising has failed to significantly replenish the coffers. News organisations are staying afloat largely by sacking staff. And among the very large number of those forced to take redundancies or simply sacked over the past couple of years have been the most senior and the most experienced, the ones that cost the most money. On top of that, in an environment where profits are scarce, media owners are eschewing public interest reporting in favour of celebrity, gossip and opinion, particularly opinion. Increasingly, practitioners who believe in the value of public service journalism are becoming the exception, not the norm. But news journalists, bloggers, and other forms of media writers still help shape much of the public information that we read and share. They still have influence, as I've said, even though many lack the rigour, training, and professionalism of the recent past. And in my experience, most of them equate the concept of the future almost entirely with digital technology. The thought process is as uncomplicated as this. Digital is the future, therefore the future is digital. Mm-hmm. And most technology journalism these days, I'm sad to say, consists of little more than puff pieces and product placements. And that's as true of supposedly venerable news sites like the Sydney Morning Herald Online as it is of BuzzFeed or TechLead. You may recall that Fairfax Media got caught out recently, only a couple of weeks ago, when it openly advertised a position for a newsroom journalist whose primary role was to weave commercial product placements into news copy. And you might also be interested to know that The Guardian, a news organisation with a very long history of seeing itself as holier than thou, is now a major generator and user of so-called native advertising. And native advertising, if you're not familiar with that term, is a deceptive way of describing what were once called advertorials, advertisements dressed up and styled to look like news stories. So into this diminished media environment comes the technology sector, offering free trips and flashy gadgets, and as a result, like the pharmaceutical industry and its often unhealthy relationship with GPs, Western media outlets have become far too close and far too dependent on Silicon Valley. That's not to say that the relationship between technology journalists and tech companies is solely about dodgy freebies, because there is also a very strong element of self-interest involved in the way many journalists present a construction of the future that is highly gadget-focused. Put bluntly, tech companies are good story generators. Apple, for instance, has long been a journalist's dream. It rarely fails to offer the media an enticing vision. In the parlance of journalism, it makes for good copy. It's often been said of the late Steve Jobs that his really great skill in life was in marketing and promotion more so than product creation. Certainly, Apple can boast a long line of very impressive devices, but in truth, most were streamlined iterations of already existing technology, the iWatch being a case in point. What Jobs did well was selling a vision of the future centred around his company's products. Little wonder then that Apple product launches are still covered by most of the world's media, including the ABC and the BBC, as genuine news events. And we're so used to that now that it's easy to forget just how unusual that actually is. But the sort of mindless free promotion that accompanied the recent release of the iWatch, for instance, just doesn't happen for the latest model Ford SUV or the latest Bosch washing machine. Another reason why journalists and other media producers are so keen to focus on commercial gadgets when they think of the future is because of the prestige factor. It's cool to be seen at the edge of technology. And not just any technology, but digital technology. And turning once again to Apple, it's easy to see how that company has very cleverly played on that cool factor over time. Apple products under Steve Jobs were equated with beauty and excellence and a certain sense of elitism, a very seductive mix. In technology, marketing, and journalistic circles, you don't just talk about Apple devices, you gush over them. And one of my favourite quotes in this regard comes from a leading US advertising executive named Rishad Tobaccowala, who was quoted when the first iPhone was released back in 2007 as saying, "When you hold an iPhone, you have a Zen experience of divinity." Almost makes you feel breathless. Now, with that sort of over-the-top enthusiasm, journalists, being a simple lot, find it very, very hard to argue against such a truth. But it isn't just the journalistic fraternity who should be held to account for modern society's often unsceptical embrace of digital consumer technology. Professor Graham Turner, the former director of the Centre for Critical and Cultural Studies at the University of Queensland, also points an accusative finger at his own former colleagues. He believes that many academics who specialise in media, digital technology and the digital world in general have lost their sense of perspective, abandoning scepticism and true academic rigour, he says, to become caught in an environment of what he calls aspirational rhetoric. Says Turner about his media academic counterparts, they exhibit, quote, a kind of excitement that moves away from looking at what's actually happening at the moment to immediately predicting the future. And he argues that media academics were among the first to embrace what's sometimes called digital optimism or digital utopianism because of long-held feelings of professional inferiority. Whereas once their opinions were thought too academic for inclusion in mainstream discussion, certainly by the media, Turner argues, suddenly, through their championing of digital utopianism, media academics now hold a prized position at the vanguard of the revolution. Of course, all of this is interesting, but it only really matters if one believes there are serious negative effects from imbuing our perception of the future with purely or predominantly digital characteristics. Well, not surprisingly, I believe there are. Our worship of digital technology not only increases passivity, I would argue, but it also lays us open to exploitation. Let me give you a topical example. Uber is less than 6 years old. It's been heralded by journalists and media academics as a prototype of future business. It operates in over 300 cities. It calls itself a member of the sharing economy, enabled by digital technology, a service that links ordinary people together via a digital platform. But when you scratch the surface just a little, Uber is nowhere near as revolutionary as it pretends to be. Underneath all the talk about being a digital disruptor, Uber is in fact nothing more than a taxi service, and a very profitable taxi service at that. Uber actually isn't a ground-up, community-based sharing cooperative. It's a multinational business headquartered in San Francisco and funded by venture capitalists and currently valued at more than $40 billion. It's very successfully used its cool, future-focused digital persona to essentially do what all taxi companies do, but in a much more profitable way. By calling itself a ride-sharing enabler, the company has basically ignored the law in many countries, and that in itself has added to its cool, futuristic, edgy persona. They're disruptors, after all, and ongoing digital disruption is a good thing because it's the future. But critics of Uber point to the fact that the company's means of operation undercuts public revenue by avoiding the sorts of government license fees that traditional operators are still forced to pay, whilst at the same time engaging drivers under a system that ignores hard-fought labour conditions, holiday pay, sick pay and the like. So Uber ignores the laws, undercuts public revenue and is eroding worker pay and conditions. But try explaining that to your average journalist and you'll be met with a stony expression of bewilderment. Because Uber is a cool digital disruptor. It's part of the sharing economy and it's digital. Therefore, it represents the future. Education provides another case in point. Across this country, from preschool to senior, classrooms are currently engaged in an ideological rush to go fully digital. Why having a fully digital classroom makes any more sense than having a fully non-digital classroom never seems to be asked or explained. Digital is good, digital is the future, so making classrooms all digital must be better. At both the state and federal level, politicians and education bureaucrats now regularly fall over themselves to embrace the digital education revolution. Why? Because education is a hot political issue. The idea of the digital classroom is popular in the media, it makes for very good copy, and so politicians believe that it resonates, or it will resonate with voters. So the idea of the digital classroom has rapidly become an unquestioned emblem of the future of pedagogy. And yet digital platforms are not a virtue in and of themselves, they're merely tools, in the same way that a pencil is a tool, or an electronic whiteboard is a tool. Owning the most sophisticated piece of technology in the world is actually rather pointless if you don't know how to use it correctly or effectively. And I have to say, I couldn't count the number of frustrated teachers I've met in recent years who bemoan the fact that there's far too much emphasis placed on getting gadgets into the classroom and far too little time spent on working out how those digital devices could actually assist and improve the learning process. In other words, what's really important is the quality of the teaching, not the particular vehicle used to teach. But once again, that's not a message that most who work in the media can or want to understand. In concluding, let me now turn to what I call the progress bias and our craving for certainty, and explain how both those factors impact on our understanding of the concept of the future. And then I want to give a few final brief thoughts about not what the role of the future is in our media, but what it should be. We like to link the concepts of the past, present, and future together almost as though they are equal. But while the past and present can and often are subject to arguments of emphasis, interpretation, and conjecture, the future is entirely speculative. We can't know for certain what lies ahead. All we can do is make best assumptions. And with my program, Future Tense, we talk about trying to understand the future by looking at the edge of change. I'm sure at least a few of you would be familiar with the famous William Gibson quote, "The future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed," which has become the motto for our program. But many people, I have to say, are uncomfortable with that sort of approach. They long for something that's much more concrete and much more certain. Harvard University risk perception and communication consultant David Ropeek puts our ongoing need to speculate about the future down to a basic human need for security and stability. Fear, he says, is the main driver behind our insatiable need to know what lies beyond. During a recent interview on the perils of prediction, he told me, quote, "We don't know what's going to happen, and not knowing intrinsically means we feel powerless. And powerlessness and a lack of control makes any situation scarier. Against that fear, prediction supplies that false sense of control," he says, "and we grasp for a sense of control by pretending that we can see into the future and know what's going to happen," end of quote. So uncertainty, the open-ended nature of the future, is not something that human beings find agreeable. We like to imagine that all things are logical, rational, and explainable. We like answers. We dislike the idea that certain things might be beyond our control or understanding. In part, I would suggest that this is the result of an overemphasis on the power of science. We in the developed world have been so clever with our scientific endeavours over the last couple of hundred years that there now exists a general understanding in society that anything and everything is ultimately solvable, that everything is ultimately knowable as long as you discover the right scientific and technological approach. And following that logic, we now have the transhumanist movement, a movement which is very popular in Silicon Valley, by the way, a movement which believes that even death can be overcome in time as long as we get the science right. Such notions, I would say, rely upon a belief in linear progress. As long as we do everything right, the future will always be better than the past. Arguably, our trust in the progress, in the progress brought about by new technologies, has by and large continued to grow since the Victorian age. And that's pretty much true across most of the Western world, or all of the Western world. But it's not necessarily the case in other places. If you're a Palestinian or an Iraqi, you might see things very differently. The path over the last 30 years, from 1985 to 2015, for most Iraqis or Palestinians, for instance, has hardly been one of ongoing progress. But in the West, our collective story has been one of upward social and economic progress, not discounting the interruption of two world wars. And that notion of the future tied so firmly to progress can be highly problematic, because it encourages us towards unreasonable optimism. No matter how grey the clouds on the horizon may appear, we tell ourselves, things will always work out for the best in the long run. And you can see this sort of wishful thinking expressed in recent discussions around the effect of automation on future employment. Sure, we're told, large numbers of middle-class jobs are expected to disappear to robots and to algorithms in future decades, but new ones will be created. However, when you prod the experts, as my program has, no one seems all that clear about what new jobs there might be and how many. There's simply a reassurance that past experience has shown that automation always leads to increased employment, despite a period of initial pain. But that, I would argue, is an argument based on belief and on hope rather than on facts. And it's an argument that ignores the very specific changes in automation between the 20th and the 21st centuries. The self-serve machines at Woolworths, the checkouts that you use to check out your own groceries, for instance, they aren't freeing up workers to be deployed in other areas of the organisation's business. They're just making people redundant. So strangely, both fear and optimism shape our understanding of the future. But why do we continue to think that some are better at predicting the future than others? Philip Tetlock from the University of Pennsylvania famously did a 20-year study of forecasting and found that the success rate of most expert predictions was little better than chance. And circling back to David Ropeik, he believes that our fear of uncertainty helps to skew us toward those forecasters and experts who offer the greatest self-confidence, the greatest sense of certainty. As a result, we don't improve our understanding of what might lie ahead. We simply increase our susceptibility to the persuasive charms of futuristic snake oil salesmen who peddle a vision of the future based largely on predetermined views, ideological underpinnings, and sheer bombast. And those character traits are exactly the character traits that make for ideal media talent in a media environment now dominated more by confident opinion rather than verifiable expertise. New York-based Duncan Watts, a former professor of sociology at Columbia University and currently a researcher at Microsoft Research, and an Australian, by the way, says we should always be wary of strong convictions. You should never be that certain about your own beliefs. The world just doesn't work that way, he says. Quote, you have to be more adaptive, you have to be more reactive, you have to think probabilistically rather than in terms of certainties. You're going to make mistakes no matter what, but you might be less inclined to make catastrophically bad mistakes, he reasons. So the picture I've presented today, I did say it was a provocation, is not a very uplifting or pretty one. In summary, the future is often portrayed in the media as technologically driven and focused. And technologically focused, that is. And the people who help us define our understanding of the future in the media landscape tend to be light on research and heavy on ideology and hubris. They often also happen to have commercial connections that compromise them. And as we all know, when it comes to predictions, they tend to get it wrong more often than they get it right. So the role of the future in the media often ends up being reduced to the level of a crude promotional tool for technology companies, dodgy academics, incurious journalists, and attention-seeking celebrity opinion makers. But of course, it doesn't have to be that way. I would like to suggest that the role of the future in the media should be twofold, and it should have two very distinct faces. Firstly, the future should act as a sort of advance party, sometimes an early warning system, a way of presenting to an audience the issues and inventions that might arise in the near future based on an analysis of current emerging trends and current cutting-edge technology. Importantly, though, it should be honest and transparent, clearly highlighting any potential conflicts of interest, reassuring people that the visions offered forth are based on the scientific method, that is, the best possible prediction based on available evidence, not on uninformed opinion, ideology, or commercial considerations. So that's my first vision of the future, or role for the future. And secondly, and just as importantly, I would argue, the role of the future should also be something completely different from that. And going back to those students at Parsons Design School in New York, it should be a vehicle through which fantasy and whim can nurture the creative and speculative thinking that not only supports invention and innovation, but also, crucially, inspires it. But once again, it needs to have honesty. Clearly defined, those two conceptions of the future could help our society to better prepare for the opportunities and pitfalls that lie directly ahead, as well as giving individuals and groups an important device for the expression of such imagination that might propel our creativity forward. And on that note, I'm happy to take questions or hear comments.